Welcome to We Are Libertarians. My name is Chris Spangle, and we are here to help you sound smarter when talking to your friends. And this is a special series called The Path to Libertarianism. As I was explaining to our guest, Jason Pye, off air, we are libertarians really are interested in helping people figure out what the heck is going on. And part of that is a lot of new people that identify as libertarians within the last year or two, or maybe curious about the philosophy or the movement, are just checking us out. And so what I want to do with the Path to Libertarianism series is not only talk about the philosophy, but also talk to people who are longtime libertarians and kind of talk about their development, so you may hear yourself in some of these conversations and it may help you kind of figure out, man, what the heck is going on? I have all these beliefs. I feel so alone and feel so strange. And so my first guest on the series is a longtime friend, great guy. His name is Jason Pye. Jason works at FreedomWorks. What is your title at FreedomWorks?
I'm the vice president of legislative affairs.
Dang, look at you. You're fancy. You get to hang out with congressmen all day, don't you?
Not all day, but some days. I do get to play in a band with one of them, which is actually kind of cool. So
we'll get to that point in your career in a little bit. I know Jason through the dreaded Brett Bittner. That is how I first met Jason. The three of us were much, much, much larger when we first met 10, 15 years ago. And I first became aware of you because of the great website United Liberty. I used to be so jealous of that website because it was so the writing was great, the brand was great, the logo was great. It was such a great website, and I went and looked at it recently, and it was just kind of like it wasn't doing anything. So you've been writing forever, haven't you? I mean, how did your career in politics kind of get started?
That's really it. And thank United Liberty was, I did that website, gosh, for like 5 years, ran it, sometimes 4 to 7 blog posts a day.
Wow.
Just writing about current events and news and politics from a libertarian perspective.
And what time frame, what years?
This was 2009. So I met the guys who owned it through Bob Barr's 2008 presidential campaign. And about, I don't know, 6 months after that campaign ended, they contacted me and said, look, it was a business. These guys own a business. And they were like, we really want someone to run this, pay you a few $100 a month just to write some content. Yeah, sure. No problem. And then it parlayed eventually into a full-time gig, but we'll get there.
Let's go back to the beginning. Like, did you grow up in a political household? Like where did your interest in politics get started?
So sort of. I mean, my parents, my mom was really the political influence in the house. She was a very like Reagan Republican. My father, he voted, but he once voted for Zell Miller because he shook his hand. Zell Miller was the governor of Georgia for 2 terms, a Democrat. He was a Southern Democrat. He eventually became a senator as a Democrat.
But and famously supported Bush in Iraq, right?
Right, yeah, famously did. And famously endorsed Bush in 2004 when Bush was up for re-election. Zell, I think passed away not too long ago.
A year or two ago.
Yeah, something like that. But, so my father was, he voted for Max Cleland because Max Cleland was a Vietnam veteran. My father was a Vietnam veteran. And Cleland famously lost re-election in 2002 as he was a senator for voting against the Department of Homeland Security because he wanted it to be unionized. And there was an ad that Saxby Chambliss ran against him with the imagery of Osama bin Laden.
It was
pretty brutal stuff. My mom was the real political influence. My father passed away in 1993. He died from cirrhosis of the liver the actual cause of death was renal failure, but it was caused by the cirrhosis of the liver. And, that influenced me pretty heavily, as a 12-year-old, something that, I think really kind of created that skepticism of government because my father was exposed to Agent Orange in Vietnam, and that's ultimately what led to or caused the cirrhosis. My father didn't drink. I never saw him drink at all, and especially when I was old enough to remember things like that, I never saw him drink. So it was just my mom and I after September 1993, and she worked She volunteered in a local campaign. I think in 1996, she worked on, like, volunteered for Phil Gramm's campaign locally. We grew up just south of Atlanta. I think my hometown is actually Jonesboro, Georgia, for those of you who've heard of Gone with the Wind. I started developing political opinions around that time. Very conservative. Very conservative opinions. My mom always told me when I was a kid that when I got older and was old enough to really listen to talk radio and understand a little bit more about politics, that I would love Neil Bortz.
Yes, that's the first person where person where I heard the word libertarian come out of their mouths.
Yes, no, exactly the same. And because I remember getting Neil Bortz's books for Christmas, or one of his books for Christmas, when I was like 18 or 17 or something like that. It was like The Terrible Truth About Liberals.
Somebody's got to say it.
So that one came out later, but I remember somebody's got to say it. But like, I got more on Bortz later there's a little bit of a story there. That's around 2008 in the timeline. So, but I was listening to Bortz like when I was like, I was old enough to drive to high school and I was in high school. I started listening to Neil Bortz. Like, it was either that or punk rock. Like, I was listening to that or like some random punk band on the way into work or on the way into school every day. And, I kept listening to Bortz, started identifying as a libertarian probably really around age 22. I had libertarian tendencies, but I agreed with Bortz. So like, if you pressed me, I would have said I was a libertarian, but, also didn't really quite, I was listening to Bortz and reading Bortz's book. I started reading other stuff. I started reading Milton Friedman. I started reading F.A. Hayek, but I just didn't really know what the label meant. But as time progressed, I started identifying as a libertarian, probably around 2004, I joined the Libertarian Party. I was elected county party chairman at the age of 23. Mm. Was elected state party chairman at the age of 25.
What year?
That was 2006.
Okay.
I got elected state party chairman. Did it for a year because I had these guys. Like, I resigned after a year because these guys. A lot of the guys in the party, and Chris, you know this all too well, that a lot of guys in the party really like to bitch about stuff. They will tell you everything that's wrong with what you're doing. But when it comes in, it's like, well, I have an idea to fix this, but it's going to take, some help. So if you want to help me, we can get on the phone. We can talk about it a little bit. They really didn't want to help.
Oh, yeah. No, I was executive director of the Indiana Party, full-time paid position. From 08 to 12, that's how you, Brittner and I met.
Right.
And it was a big, big reason that I left is that I had just not done what so many people had told me they wanted me to do.
Yeah.
That many people were unhappy with me, and because I would say, well, I need you to step up and own this project. I mean, it's people who are... The Libertarian Party, by and large, I found to be a lot of really great people, really great friends. I think about those years all the time and how much I love those people. But there are like 10% of the people that you run across that are just so foul that you can't stand to be around it. It really did kind of suck. So it's hard being in leadership.
No, absolutely was hard being in leadership, which is why I never, like, people approached me about running for, LNC, regional representative. And I was like, no, I don't want to be in leadership anymore. Like, the experience as chairman really ruined the party for me in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And, I would go to our executive committee meetings and, I'm 25, like, I'm probably one of, if not the youngest state chair in the country. And I kind of knew what I was doing, but like also didn't have any support in the process. And like, I knew how to run a business meeting. I knew how to do other things, but like all the real power in terms of like hiring personnel and all that stuff came from the vice chair, like under our bylaws. And yeah, it's so weird. The vice chair had all the power. And of course, the vice chair at the time was someone who was mentoring me as much as he could. He was a business guy. very great guy. His name's Jack Atkins. Jack was great. But there was only so much he could do with trying to run a business at the same time. So it was what it was. So after the most controversial thing I had to deal with when I was chairman was putting Bob Barr on the LNC. Mm. And at the time, I didn't really know Bob that well. I had met him. Nice guy. Knew him from the Clinton impeachment in the late 90s.
Yeah, he was the House manager of the Clinton impeachment. Forced to resign because he was a congressman who found out that he was having an affair. He was...
No. That was Bob Livingston.
Oh, okay. I thought Bob Barr had... Okay, so I thought Barr had it as well, but...
No. So Bob, there was a minor little thing that came up during the impeachment scandal, which I probably am not at liberty to talk about because Bob's my mentor in politics when it's all said and done.
I apologize to Bob Barr for besmirching his reputation, but he was controversial in the party because of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act.
That's correct. And right. Patriot Act.
Yes, and the Patriot
which,
Act.
Both of which he's recanted. At least he recanted, I think it was Section 2 of DOMA, which had been used to force states or to kind of push states in the direction of banning same-sex marriage.
Right.
But he, you know, he even wrote a piece about that, I think, after the fact, after DOMA was struck down. But he recanted his support for the Patriot Act. He even went to work, all lobbied with the ACLU to repeal the Patriot Act afterwards. But all that aside, so Bob had just left the Republican Party. I think he voted for Michael Bednarik in 2004, left the Republican Party in 2005, and the orders came down from on high from the National Party folks that Bob was to be a deal had been cut to put Bob on the LNC as a Southeastern representative. So it was Alicia Mattson and I from Tennessee who were in charge of making it happen. We ran into some problems. Obviously North Carolina was a problem for us. Some people in Tennessee, but we got it done. And that was the final straw for me.
Right.
And I was just like, I'm done here. Like, fuck it. I'm done. Like, I'm not doing this anymore.
What specifically was the catalyst? I mean, what was it effective and they weren't?
No, it was just, I think for them, if he wasn't, you know, it's the same, it's the same old libertarian argument. He is not libertarian enough. He's a Republican. He'll be a Republican plant. He's going to wind up, setting the party back. You know, those are the arguments against doing it. And, you know, libertarians, like 95% of us do not have a personality. I keep telling Jess Mears this, like libertarians, like if we had most of us don't have a personality, and you know, I keep telling her she's kind of like an unusual fit for the party because she has a personality.
I would argue that it's identity. There are so many people within the libertarian movement where this is the sole piece of their identity, and so every criticism of anything that they hold dear becomes a personal attack, as opposed to, you know, I'm sitting next to a guy who I'm having lunch. If you remember Ed Coleman when he ran for city council, the National Party gave him some money, and the guy that I was having lunch with was the Marion County GOP chair who put out this horrendous, inaccurate mailer, this hit piece. He whipped it out, showed it to me. I go, well, now you're buying me lunch. You know, it didn't faze me because I don't really care. Like, it's being a libertarian is part of my identity. And so I just think that many people in the party, for them, it is so personal that when a Bob Barr or a Gary Johnson comes along, they feel threatened because their club is threatened, despite the fact that Gary Johnson tripled the national percentages and got tons of ballot access for new states, or a Bob Barr has relationships that we might not have had access to previously. Yeah. And so instead of viewing that as an asset, they view it as a threat. It's a very odd thing.
Yeah. So you're exactly right. I think the one thing you hit on that, and look, the problems, most of the problem that we had was from like the radical faction of the party.
Right.
But there were people in the radical faction of the party who I really loved and respected, like Angela Keaton and Nick Sarwark and, you know, people like that, who I really had a lot of respect for. And you know, especially like these people were easier to talk to, especially because you could identify with certain issues they were working on. With Angela was always like anti-war, and with Nick, I mean, Nick was always concerned about process, and I shared those concerns about process. But anyway, so like got Bob on the LNC. I promptly stepped down. The vice chair became chair, and I kind of just withdrew from the party for a couple of years. Came back in 2008. And worked for Bob Barr's presidential campaign in 2008, which, look, we had problems. the much criticized campaign. You know, Bob played the role of candidate very well, in the sense of he did not micromanage his management staff. So Russ Verney, Shane Corey, others were in charge of decisions on that campaign. Bob went along with those decisions because he understood his role was to go out and talk about the message.
Right.
So, you know, obviously Bob didn't do as well as we had hoped. Be that as it may, it was a great experience. I got to know Bob very well during that campaign. We became very close friends, and still are very close friends. So after that, I go back to work. I'm the legislative director of the Libertarian Party of Georgia. So 4 months of the year, I'm like reviewing legislation, using almost all my vacation time from my professional life to go and to, you know, talk with lawmakers and about not just like ballot access, but like other bills that are being introduced that, you know, that are kind of a front to libertarianism, and, you know, stay involved in the party through 2012.
Let me stop you there and let me ask you, what were you doing for a living, and what was it about reviewing the legislation and talking to legislators? Where did you find passion? Why were you passionate about that?
No one else was doing it. Like, so I was a contributor at the time. This is where I was going to take a step back. So it's a good question, because I was going to kind of cover this anyway. So one of the things that I had been doing since like 2006, I had started contributing on a blog called Peach Pundit, which was like Georgia's most well-known political blog until it shut down like 3-4 years ago or something like that. So Eric Erickson, who's now a talk show host in Metro Atlanta, founder of Red State, or co-founder of Red State, he invited me to be like the libertarian voice on Peach Pundit. So I was writing about Georgia politics from that perspective, and I noticed no one like really was covering what was happening in the legislature very much. So I decided to take it upon myself to do it. So, you know, I would just, you know, talk about what was happening, and that led to the creation of another website called Georgia Legislative Watch, where we were like in depth, like talking and writing about like the budget, because the budget is the biggest thing the legislature did all year long, different pieces of legislation that were coming forward. So that led me to learn how to read a bill, to understand policy and politics a little bit better in terms of like legislative policy and politics. And and so that kind of was like natural for me to take that role inside the Libertarian Party, to still be active and contribute in some way, even though it wasn't a paid thing or anything like that. Because my day job, I was working in mostly like life insurance. So like I was licensed until the end of 2018 in Georgia for life and health. Then I let my license lapse. I figured I didn't need it anymore because I had changed careers. But you know, Peach Pundit led to, and the Barr campaign led to United Liberty, which you mentioned earlier, and which was a passion project owned by a company that did all the web development work for Ron Paul's campaign in 2008, the web development for Bob Barr's campaign in 2008. I think they did some stuff for the LP too.
I think they did their website. What was it, Terra Firma? Was that the
Terra Eclipse?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it was. So, in 2012, they offered me a full-time job that was, based in DC. So I quit my job in the insurance industry and took this job in DC. And, it was initially like a full-time in DC thing, but like, you know, we weren't in a position, suffering from the fallout that was the 2007-2008 financial crisis. We weren't in a position to sell our home. Right. We lost a lot of our value in our house. So I was basically going to work in DC for 2 weeks and then coming home every other weekend. And that, you know, started taking a little bit of a toll on my marriage. And so I ended up just moving home and working from home full time. So, and I come up to DC every, you know, either every month or every couple months, whatever the case may be. September 2014, and this, again, just a note, I didn't even know, I actually thought United Liberty, you mentioned you went on there not too long ago. I thought the website like died.
No, it still exists. It's not been updated. Yeah.
I tried to go on there because I was writing something not too long ago. And I'm like, I knew I wrote about this before. I just can't, I think it was United Liberty. So I tried to go into United Liberty to find it and like do a Google site search and couldn't find, like when I click on a link, it was like dead. Couldn't connect the server. And I was like, okay, well, that's fine. I wrote, you know, I probably wrote 1,000 articles for this website. That's great. I can't find any of my work.
And that's a tip for you young bloggers. Always get an export when you leave or stop doing something because you will lose it. I've got all my exports rolled into like the We Are Libertarians website because I own it. I keep it, you know, so I've got all that stuff squirreled away. You just have to or else you lose it.
Yeah, truer words could not have been spoken. I mean, that's don't get me wrong. There's some work on that website that like I would rather not. It's like when I played music too. I mean, I played at a punk band for 6 years from like the end of high school until I was probably like 23, and I still play music. And I go back and listen to our first couple like recordings, and I'm like, God, we had no business.
So I remember like, there was a United Liberty podcast, and I tuned in. I think I'd started Wall at that point, and I was like, this is the shit. I finally did something better than United Liberty. I was so excited that you guys were bad at it.
what was so bad about it?
The quality of the content was good. It was the blog talk radio, like you were on phone lines or something, and so I was just like.
Skype.
Right.
It was Skype with the call in option. Like I was paying for that. Like, yeah. It was.
I offended my guest. I apologize.
No. It was. Thankfully, it wasn't Blog Talk Radio, but it wasn't much better than Blog. And like we were recording, and we would edit through Audacity, which was like not the best platform.
Right. Either.
Like today, you kids have GarageBand and all that stuff, and other editing services. And yeah, you guys had. I didn't. Put a lot of effort into like learning about what was the best thing to have.
No, Jason, I was stupid and spent money I didn't have on equipment. It's because I was a little reckless, but I'm glad that I was. So
no, I remember asking my boss for a budget to purchase like a, you know, a 4-track recorder to or like a 4-track soundboard. To purchase like you know a Mac to purchase like all the stuff I needed to do it right. Because I knew the quality wasn't as good as it could have been, but I wanted to do it right. But he every time he told me, he's like, well, "What's your budget?" I was like, "Probably about $2,000." He's like, "Yeah, no."
Yeah, so, well, and there wasn't money or nobody knew what a podcast was then. I mean, this was 10 years ago.
No, I mean this is a podcast. I mean, because I remember when podcasts became a thing, like they were really big, like 2005 for like a minute, and then it kind of died. And next thing I know, like. Because I had a local podcast back in like 2005, 2006. I called it the Piecast.
Nice.
Which is nice play on words. But like I did a few episodes of that and realized like the listenership wasn't there for it and just let it die. And I'm just all of a sudden podcasts become a thing again. And I'm just like, well, maybe I should relaunch one, you know? I mean, like,
now's the time.
But like, I don't have the time. I don't have the time for it. That's the sad thing. But, you know, UL was huge and it parlayed into other things. Like, you know, I unfortunately TerraClips had to downsize a little bit. So I was let go. I was laid off and I was unemployed for all of a week when I called a friend of mine at FreedomWorks and said, hey, do you know of any jobs open? Like I was feeling sorry for myself. I was sitting in my office at home playing Dashboard Confessional songs, being sad, super emo and called my friend up. And said, I'm looking for a job. Do you know of anything? She's like, wait, you don't have a job right now? I was like, oh, no, I don't. So she's like, let me call you back. So she goes and talks to at the time, the executive vice president of FreedomWorks, Adam Brandon. And Adam and I were friends. We knew each other. And so she calls me back. She's like, hey, Adam's going to call you in a little bit. So Adam calls me 5 times that day. And by the last call, he had an offer. We had an agreement in principle.
That's great
for me to come work for FreedomWorks. And it was really cool. They really took care of me. I basically started off with they paid me retroactively to my layoff date, which was amazing. And then said, look, you don't need to start until the beginning of October. So this was mid September. So they said, spend 2 weeks, stay at home, spend 2 weeks, just kind of studying what we've been doing. You don't really have to do it. We're not asking you to write anything. We're not asking you to do anything. And then we'll fly up to DC beginning of October. So you can, firstly, he's like, I think you're gonna be a morale boost for the staff. Because everybody knew me, but they kind of tried to keep it as big a secret as possible that I was coming on board because I was well-liked and, they wanted it to be a surprise. And, I think somebody told everybody at some point though, because it wasn't as big a surprise when I walked in the door as I think Adam intended for it
to be.
That's
funny.
So I've been there ever since and, have gone up the chain at FreedomWorks from, just a lowly policy analyst, to the VP of Legislative Affairs.
So let me ask this, just kind of jumping back before we get into FreedomWorks, because I think it's an interesting organization. I've got a bunch of questions about it. How I think when you're in the libertarian movement, it's a small world, so it's easy to kind of navigate. It's easy to be the 25-year-old that's sort of bright, and they go, let's make him chair and you know, and to network. But where do you get off being an insurance salesman who just decides I'm going to be a blogger and be a policy analyst? And then how did you turn yourself into somebody that does politics and policy analyst and what you love to do full time? I think there are a lot of people going, I'm really into libertarianism and liberty, but I don't know if I could ever make a career out of it. Do you attribute your transition into a full-time role to be? Is it your networking skills? Is it just that people noticed you and they said, he's bright, let's hire him? What was it in what made this possible for you?
I think you describe all that, and also you factor in the fact that I don't have a college degree.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah, because I dropped out after two semesters and just said, I don't want to do this anymore. I think it's my, we talk about libertarians without a personality earlier. I think I am, and I also think you are examples of libertarians who have a personality and who can work with people when they want to.
Then how does that explain Bittner?
That's a great question.
Because he has a personality. It's just Bittner, you know?
I know.
I'm just kidding. I'm just teasing our friend Brett. He's great. I like Morgan a lot better than Bittner,
I've never met Morgan, but Bittner is going to get pissed off at me because I didn't actually answer your question.
I had to go ahead. That's exactly Brett, what I want.
Brett is one of my oldest friends, and I love the dude to death. And Brett, when you hear this, give Raptor a pet for me. Raptor is one of actually my wife and I's dog that we actually gave to Bittner after some things that happened at home. The dog got into a fight with one of our other dogs and it didn't end so well for poor Raptor. So we realizing that we couldn't keep him, we gave him to Brett. So Brett's good people and one of the nicest people I know. So, one of the best people I know, certainly.
But back to the personality thing.
Yeah. I was good at networking. I have this ability, or so I've been told, to talk to anyone. I can talk to literally anyone. Can have a conversation with anyone. Example of this: yesterday, I went to go buy. I had to do some business with the county, and I had the front desk lady. Ended up sitting there talking to her about our damn cats for 20 minutes before I finally said, I actually got to get going. So can we I've enjoyed the conversation, but I have to go get, I'm meeting a friend for lunch. So, which was true, but, anyway, so, I think it's just a libertarian with personality who despite not having all the tools necessary, and which is probably why I didn't start doing this full time until I was 32 years old or almost 32 years old. Who was willing to put in the hard work that it takes to get to that point. Learning how to read a piece of legislation, learning how to talk to lawmakers, learning how to, and today really learning how to talk to congressional staff, and also as much as I don't like to say this, kind of understanding how to play the game a little bit, even though I don't like playing the game, but like doing the things in politics that are necessary without screwing anybody over are necessary to do the job.
Right.
Which means understanding that sometimes you do have to make compromises, and you're not always going to like the compromises that you have to make. But
sometimes you have
to
be deferential to people that you don't want to be deferential to because you don't really respect them. Yeah.
Yeah. There's certainly the congressional level. There are people I've had to be deferential to who I don't respect and who I don't particularly care for. There are some who I would sooner, you know, I don't know. I mean, there are offices I've had to deal with who I would just sooner never deal with again. Most of that's at the staff level. I mean, most members I encounter are actually very nice and very easy to get along with. Some aren't. But most of the ones I've met with, this congressional staff always, I'm sure you'll be shocked to know that a lot of congressional staffers who you encounter have their own agendas that don't always align with their boss. It's like I always tell people, like even the baristas at Starbucks have their own agenda in DC. Just getting to this point has just been an exercise in like working 60 hours a week or working the time I was running UL, I was working three jobs. Like I don't think a lot of people realize that. So I had my day job in the insurance industry. I ran United Liberty and I was working for Congressman Barr or former Congressman Barr. At that time, between 2010 and 2012, I was working for him doing a lot of research for the op-eds he was writing. So when I first started doing that, that was three a week. So, and then I had to do other things like write long form pieces for him for like SCOTUS blog and a few other things that kind of kicked my ass. And like, so I was probably putting in 80 hours a week, if not more, at various points. And like between 2010 through 2012. Like I had three jobs at that time.
I've always been the same way, and I think I don't have a college degree either, and I always had the sense that I had to work people under the table because I had to work harder because I had to be more competitive because I need to network because I'm not going to get the same opportunities that others might.
Yep.
And I really think that the key I identify with your story because push through that insecurity. Talk to that person you don't want to talk to. Be nice to the person that you don't think you should be nice to. Do do it multiple times. And so it's like, I don't know how to read a bill and then examine it. Well, just start doing it. And eventually you become an expert if you do it enough. Like when I started this podcast, it's like, and maybe you felt this too in the beginning, who the hell am I to be a political expert on a podcast? And a friend said to me, like, you've been executive director. You're working in politics professionally. Why would you think that you're not? And I still feel that way. I still feel like I can't believe people listen to me, but they do. And so don't dishonor that.
You're 100% right. I think for me, I think I've already reached the pinnacle of my career. It's kind of weird to like be 39 years old and be like, you know, I've already reached my max, like my maximum point. And that was 2018. It was, I got invited to the White House for a bill signing ceremony. So I got to sit in the Oval Office and look, like Trump or not, like, I don't think it's any secret that I don't particularly care for the guy. And I didn't vote in 2016 because I didn't like any of the candidates. And as much as I love and respect Gary Johnson, like I could not stand Bill Weld.
Right.
And Gary, I think, had done some things in his campaign that really rubbed me the wrong way. Like, come on, you don't know what Aleppo is?
Right.
Like, you know, but I got invited to the bill signing ceremony in December 2018 for the First Step Act, which that was a bill I busted my ass for. That was, I've told this story several times, but like the last 6 months of 2018, that bill was 55% of my lobbying activity. I mean, I'm a lobbyist. That's what I am. That's what I do.
What does the act do, inform our listeners?
Yeah. So the First Step Act was a landmark criminal justice reform bill that it was part of the original First Step Act was just prison reform, basically requiring programming inside the Bureau of Prisons. So in all federal correctional institutions designed to reduce recidivism, each prisoner would be subject to a risk and needs assessment, determining their level, their risk of becoming a repeat offender. So they would structure programming based on that risk assessment for the prisoner, things they need to complete, be it work skills, education, job training, maybe Bible study would be part. I mean, whatever the case may be, the program is designed to be intensive, where it gradually lowers their risk so they can earn time credits that they can cash in once they become low risk or minimal risk to cash in to leave prison early. Now they still have to serve out their sentence, but they can serve it out in home confinement or at a halfway house, for example. So, or under community supervision. So that was Title I of the bill. Title IV of the bill was the kind of landmark part of it. And certainly the recidivism reduction side was a big deal, and it was modeled after states that had done criminal justice reform, like Georgia, like Texas, like South Carolina, Utah. So there's like 30 something states have done stuff like this, recidivism reduction. But Title IV of the bill were sentencing reforms. So you're rolling back some excesses of the past, the war on drugs. Making the crack cocaine disparity retroactive, or the reduction of the disparity retroactive. So that came in 2010. It was the Fair Sentencing Act. It cut the disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine from 100-1 to 18-1, but it wasn't made retroactive by Congress. So First Step Act made that retroactive. It was reducing the penalty. And a lot of people may not realize this. The penalty for crack cocaine was at one point 100 times worse than the penalty for powdered cocaine. You could have the same amount, but the penalty for the crack cocaine was 100 times worse.
Gee, wonder why that could be.
One thing I would say. The interesting thing about it is, if you go and look at the legislative history of that bill, about half the members of the Congressional Black Caucus voted for it.
Really?
So I'll say this: the bill wasn't racist. The outcomes had a racial disparity, which is why it needed to be fixed. And that got fixed. There were three other sentencing reforms in that bill. There were some that reduced penalties. The three strikes and you're out. If you commit a drug felony three times, you get life. We lowered that to 25 years. So again, 25 years is more than enough. There were a couple other sentencing reforms. One that was tied back to the story of Weldon Angelos. Don't need to get into that here, but it was a guy who was given 55 years for a drug crime. Simply because he had a firearm in his possession. He didn't brandish it. He didn't use it. He just had it. But he was given a minimum of 55 years. There was three penalties stacked on top of each other, 5, 25, 25. He's now out of prison. They came back in and dropped the charges about three years ago. So he's been out for a while. And he's doing a documentary on the criminal justice system. But we fixed that penalty to no longer allow it to be stacked.
So what you're saying is, if you're deferential to the right people and you play the game a little bit, you too can enact legislation that is signed by a president who decries law and order all the time. Fascinating.
Who says we have a violent crime problem, and yet violent crime rates are the second lowest point since like 1993.
Yeah, so...
In 1992, I think, was the peak.
What does it take to get something like that done? Like, what does the on-the-ground work look like to actually pass a bill like that?
It was a lot of meetings, a lot of writing, because we had opposition when the original First Step Act passed. Just the prison side, they didn't have any of the other stuff in it. We only lost two Republicans. That was Steve King, who's a racist, like an actual racist.
Okay,
His name escapes me. Well, Bill Huizinga from, I think, Michigan, which kind of that one actually surprised us a little bit. And it turned out he had like a problem with one part of the bill, like a very tiny part of the bill. It didn't have anything to do with like the rest of it. It was like it dealt with federal prison industries, which is an actual thing. And so we get it over the Senate, and we had to do some response because there are a few people who were causing us headaches, who were just writing like the First Step Act was going to let out all these illegal immigrants, of course, because that's, you know, they don't conservatives don't like brown people. let me rephrase. Most conservatives don't like brown people. And Yeah, I mean, so that was, so we were writing responses about that. We were writing responses like to people who were saying child molesters are going to be let free, murderers are going to be let free, violent criminals are going to be let free. And we're just like, no, like all that stuff is expressly prohibited in the bill. Like, stop being stupid.
Stop lying, so, maybe.
The stop lying. Well,
propaganda may be the more accurate.
I mean, this was Jeff Sessions. Like, no joke. Mm-hmm. Like, we found this out when we got to the Senate. That Jeff Sessions, like the DOJ, was actually in this on the Senate side when we got the bill over to the Senate. Like, the bill passed with like 300 and I think it was like 350 yay votes. Like, there were Democrats who voted against it because it didn't go far enough. So we get over to the Senate, and by the way, of my target legislators, we only lost one on the House side, and that was Huizenga. So we get over to the Senate side. Senate side, we knew was more of an uphill battle. Chuck Grassley, the chairman of House or Senate Judiciary, wanted sentencing reform. We agreed, but it was a matter of like what was in the world of the possible. And the White House had not yet said they were on board with sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember being in a meeting with Jared Kushner, who looked me dead in the eye and said, "We want a clean prison bill." And I responded, "Well, you will get that in the House, but you may not get that in the Senate."
Meaning a clean bill, meaning what?
Meaning no sentencing reforms, no other things attached to it. They just wanted prison reform and prison reform only. And that was the recidivism reduction stuff was all they wanted, which was what the president had said in his State of the Union address in, I think, February of 2018, was that he talked about prison reform. There was like a line in there about it. And he didn't say anything about sentencing. But we knew, like, we were talking, I mean, I was having almost, there was a point where I was talking daily with Senator Mike Lee and just texting with him, just seeing, like, who are our targets? Like, this is what we're hearing. What are you hearing? Like, exchanging information. I was talking to other congressional staff, like, again, almost daily at different points. So we passed that bill in May of 2018. It's over the Senate. And it's like from May to August, nothing's happening. Nothing's happening on the First Step Act. It's not dead. It's just not moving. it's only mostly dead, to quote a famous movie. Ted Cruz would be proud of that, by the way. And he was one of our, that's the really funny thing. If you go look at the pictures from the bill signing ceremony, I'm blocked in more than half of them. And the reason I'm blocked, and like you, because there's one picture, I think, from AP that you can actually see me in it. And I'm behind Ted Cruz. The rest of the pictures, Ted Cruz is blocking me from any camera view. So like, but he and his staff were actually, his staffer was one of the worst people I dealt with the entire time on this bill. His staffer, Ben Sasse's staff. There were a few other staffers I met with who were just like complete assholes about the bill, like not understanding what it was, not really making the effort to understand what it was. Anyway, we charged forward. Finally, the White House in August, the president said he was on board with, I think the White House actually told us in like July, late July, that they were going to be on board with sentencing. The president formally announced it in August after in a press conference or a meeting with Chairman Grassley and others. We get sentencing added in, or we know what sentencing reforms we're gonna get added in. And we've been advocating for a long time. There was a short time where we were just like, maybe we're not gonna get sentencing, maybe we just have to let it go. But Grassley staff, you know, would call me up, make sure we were still on board. It's like, yeah, we're on board, but like, how much are we gonna get? Like, are we gonna get anything here? Like, does this kill the whole thing? Like, we were getting a little nervous there for a while. But to Chairman Grassley's credit, he kept forging ahead. Senator Lee did too. Senator Lee wanted the sentencing reforms added. Chairman, now Judiciary Chairman Graham, who was an ally on this. Yeah. I know a lot of libertarians don't like Lindsey Graham, and I certainly have my issues with him, but he was really good on this issue. Tim Scott was also involved. There were several others who may not have been very vocal or out, like in the news talking about it, but they were involved behind the scenes. The process, we were at a point where like there were offices saying we want to try to get this bill, our bill to dealing with the treatment of marijuana, states have legalized marijuana, like to ease treatment for them. And like, we were just like, look, we don't take a position on that issue. Like, I personally do not care. Like,
right.
Like, you know, that's where the libertarian side of me still is very much there. Like, I'm the worst libertarian in the sense that, like, I don't smoke weed. So I think it smells terrible, and yeah, I can't stand it. But I don't give a shit if you do it. Yeah. So we were trying to dissuade that kind of stuff from getting put in the bill because we didn't want to blow it up. We knew that stuff would not have helped. Even some of the sponsors, the advocates of First Step would not have touched that. So we finally get the bill to a place where we can support it. It's got the prison reforms with some changes. More exceptions were added to weed out some offenders. And that was all political in nature. It's just something you had to live with, even if you didn't like it. Because our view was the risk assessment would always handle stuff like that. Mm-hmm. If someone was going to be high risk, if the risk assessment could be tailored in a way to ensure that people who were ultimately going to be high risk never got out of prison. But the exceptions were political and had to be put in because we were getting hammered on that stuff. And it was mainly Tom Cotton and John Kennedy, who are two of my least favorite senators.
Yep.
Like, they're right there with Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and Sheldon Whitehouse and others. And to his credit, Sheldon Whitehouse was actually very much involved in this bill and was at the bill signing ceremony. He's also a very nice guy. I'll give him that much, even though I disagree with him on so much politically. Go through the process. Like I said, 55% of my lobbying activity, I've been working on criminal justice reform for, at that point, 4 years. It's the first thing they gave me when I joined Freedom Works in 2014. And, very passionate about the issue, became very knowledgeable about the issue through the process of the predecessor bill was the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, and then we had First Step Act. And 87 to I think 12 was the vote in the Senate, and that was December of 2018. We knew we won when we got cloture, because you need 60 for cloture, and then all 12 votes we lost were Republicans. It would have been 88 to 12, but Lindsey Graham couldn't be there. He was in Afghanistan. And then we go back over to the House. We start doing some touches in the House, and they were going to put the, for those of you who don't know this, there are different ways. There's different treatment of a bill. Sometimes the fun little secret of Congress, at least the House, is that most legislation that passed is actually not that controversial, and they pass on under the suspension of the rules. So like next week, for example, there are 10 bills coming to the floor that I know of. Eight of those are going to be passed under suspension of the rules, which means that requires 291, two-thirds vote to suspend the rules and pass, or a voice vote. And everything else, the controversial stuff comes out under a rule, which either limits amendments, or they have an open amendment process, or they don't have any amendments at all. So there are two bills coming out next week under a rule. So First Step, because I was hearing about so many Republicans potentially voting no on it, I was like, guys, I told the White House this, like, guys, maybe we should tell Republican leadership to put this out under a rule. That way we know we have 218, we know we'll get almost every Democrat, if not all of them. And that was a little bit of a concern too about we were worried Democrats may vote no to not give the president a win.
So essentially you're going to say to the House, okay, let's open this up to amendments, which can be kind of a scary thing.
No, this is really hard to explain because this is like minutia and inside baseball of the House, but like the House Rules Committee can take a bill and they can create a rule that there's open rules, there are structured rules, and there are closed rules. Open rules means any amendment can be introduced on the floor. A structured rule means only certain amendments can be considered on the floor. A closed rule means no amendments can be considered on the floor. So this was the first time in my life where I was basically telling the White House, as well as some in congressional leadership and House leadership, because Republicans still held the House at the time, I was like, we should bring this out under a rule, under a closed rule. And I have never said those words in my entire life, at least in my professional life. But I was like, I was openly advocating for like, let's put this out under, not under regular order, not allow amendments, and just let's get it over with. Because we know we have 218 votes, so let's just get it over with. They didn't whip the bill, which means count the votes, but they I was told that they had the 291 to pass it, and sure enough, they did. I think the bill passed again with 350 votes. We lost more Republicans this time around, including some friends, and that's always been something that's bothered me. But some good friends of ours, especially good friends of mine on a personal level, voted no. But we still got it passed. I think we lost 59 Republicans in total. I don't think any Democrats voted no. Bill passed, got signed into law. I think I've worked on probably at this point 20 different bills that have become law, some harder than others. And that includes the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. I worked on that, but like everybody worked on that. Mm. But there were only a few of us who were working on the First Step Act and got it to a point where it could pass. And, so, you know, First Step Act will, like I said, probably already reached the pinnacle of my career. That one, that bill would probably be the pinnacle of my career. There's a lot more work on criminal justice to be done. We got something tucked into the National Defense Authorization Act for 2020. It's called the Fair Chance Act, which it's geared towards government jobs and jobs specific to a federal contract. So basically, you cannot ask for someone's criminal history, before the conditional offer phase.
Right.
Then you can run a background check on them. If something comes up, then you can deny them.
So let me ask you this, like through this process, where does your personal philosophy now fall? Like, how has that changed what you thought about libertarianism and politics in general, your ideology before this job and now after working with Congress directly?
No, I mean, look, I'm still very much a libertarian. I kind of, the way I caveat my personal political views, personal political philosophy, is I'm a practical libertarian, dare I say a pragmatic libertarian, in the sense that I know the evil pragmatic. I mean, I've always been somewhat of a pragmatist, even in my days in the LP. Yeah. I was a pragmatist. And ultimately, the reason I left the LP is when it was made very clear to me that it was a club, not a serious political party.
Let me pause you right there. Your mic is rubbing on your beard.
Oh, sorry. This is my wife's fault. She's been telling me to grow up.
The dangers of being handsome.
That's why I left the LP, was because I was basically told this was a club, and that the problem with people like me was we wanted to get people elected, and that's not what the LP is intended to do. And that person who said that became the secretary of the party the next day. And I was just like, I'm done.
Right.
I'm done here. And that's when I left the party. So that was right after the convention in 2012. More and more I thought about it, less and less I thought that anybody in the LP was serious. There were certainly people who were serious, like you and Brett and Stephen Gordon, a few others, God rest his soul, Gordo.
But when Vermin Supreme gets 44 votes, it's not that Vermin Supreme is running that makes it a joke. It's that 44 people in New Hampshire
voted for him.
As if,
yeah.
Okay, well, you're either trolling or you're serious about voting for him, which means you're not serious. And it's just like, it's a bellwether moment where you just sort of go, okay, this party doesn't understand the opportunity that they have.
No, they really don't. I mean, and it's I consider Nick Sarwark a friend, but I think Nick, sarcasm and his personality don't always translate really well over the internet.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think he's been a decent chair, but I think he shoots himself in the foot a lot.
I agree with that.
Yeah, self-inflicted wounds for no reason.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I like Nick a lot. I think a lot of them, but like, you know, just the party itself, I just don't think has grown because it insists on being a purist philosophy, or they adhere to, they're unwilling to move away into like the practical side of things. And like the practical side of things, I'm not talking about like surrendering your principles. I'm talking about you're at your own 1 yard line and you keep throwing Hail Marys down the field and you expect to get a touchdown every time. Football doesn't work that way. It's a game of inches and you have to move the ball downfield in whatever way you can. Maybe it's a 4 yard screen pass to your running back. Maybe it's 2 yards up the middle from your running back. Maybe it's a 20 yard pass downfield. You don't get anything done when you constantly insist on purity. And I know FreedomWorks has often been accused of being purity for profit. The fact is, first of all, especially with me running the Lead Shop, like we try to be as practical as possible. If there's First Step Act was not the bill I would have written. If you tell me I have 218 votes in the House and 60 in the Senate to pass a criminal justice bill, if you tell me what you want, that bill would not have been the bill I got, or I would have done. I would have eliminated all mandatory minimums. I would have, I would have gone even bigger on the recidivism reduction side. I would have restored Pell Grants for prisoners. Those are things I would have restored federal parole. Those are things I would have done. But I that was not the world in which I lived. So I had to be practical about it and get something done. That is what I'm paid to do, is to pass legislation. I fail a lot. Absolutely. Or stop bad legislation. That's another thing I'm paid to do. And I fail a lot because politics in DC aren't easy. You always have Republicans who are going to vote with Democrats, and Republicans suck anyway. Yeah. So there's 40 members of Congress who I can regularly count on to do what I want them. Well, there's 40 members of the House and probably like five in the Senate who I can regularly count on to do what I want them to do.
Right. So let me ask you about FreedomWorks, because, all right, so you came in after the Tea Party era, if you came in like 2014, right? So what is FreedomWorks? What does it do? I have heard, it's viewed with suspicion, but everything I've seen from you or Kibbe or, Julie Borowski worked there. I don't know if she still does. Austin Peterson, I think, worked it there at one point. Like, they have a habit of hiring really solid libertarian people. What is FreedomWorks and what do they do?
So FreedomWorks, basically we have a network of 5 million activists across the country. We train them and educate them and mobilize them on issues related to the personal liberty, economic freedom, and the rule of law. So when you're pushing a bill through like First Step Act or trying to stop a budget or pass tax cuts, you mobilize them and drive messages to their lawmakers, urging them to support or oppose whatever you're working on. And we also do that. We also run a number of state campaigns related to everything from school choice to criminal justice reform to cutting taxes to, whatever the case may be, anything that comes up. We do that, a lot of that state work through partnerships with state-based think tanks or advocacy organizations. But our bread and butter has always been grassroots activism. So we are most responsive, and maybe this will shed some light, to people who view us skeptically. We are responsive to our activist community. So our activist community is obviously very keen on Trump, so we have to be responsive to that, even though some people like me on staff aren't particularly fond of Trump. Look, spending has grown dramatically on his watch, and I think that's worthy of criticism. But at the same time, the impeachment process, I think, has been handled horribly by House Democrats, and I don't think he should be convicted. Plus, it's going to tear the nation even further apart, and we're already so politically divided. I think it's bad timing. And I thought the Clinton impeachment was a bad idea too, especially in hindsight. But that's what we do. My job is to be the face of the organization on Capitol Hill, and it's not a beautiful face, but I am the face of the organization.
How do I make that joke without really being insulting? But thank you for,
I did it for
the layup.
You.
Yeah.
At least hopefully I did it more politely than you would have.
There's varying degrees, how it is.
Like, you kind of are an asshole, but I'm kidding.
But I'm your asshole.
You have to balance things with an activist community that's very supportive of Trump, and we my team especially do take some liberties from time to time, supporting things like, look, I have a paper coming out next week that's 48 pages, I think 40 of them are written by me. That talks about limiting the power of the presidency and restoring Article One and making sure Congress has the tools it needs to restore itself, to be the first branch of government, which is what it was intended to be, to restore the separation of powers and ensure checks and balances. Because, like him or not, Bob Barr had a great quote back in 2008. He said, every president takes the power of his predecessor as a floor and not a ceiling. And if we don't put a stop to that at some point in time, we're not going to have much liberty left.
Right.
So that paper again comes out, I think, on Tuesday. So I'm really excited about it. So
Where can they read that if they want to read that?
If you're on my newsletter, you'll get first dibs. My newsletter comes out Mondays. You can go to my Twitter account, twitter.com/pie, and you can sign up for my newsletter. It's the pinned tweet at the top of that.
P-Y-E.
Yeah. You can click on that link at the top. It's the pinned tweet there and sign up for it. Or you can just email me at jpie@freedomworks.org and ask me to sign you up. But yeah, I mean, everything we do is granted and making things better for the American people from a liberty standpoint. Again, it's sort of, it can be pragmatic at times, depending on what we're working on. It's not always, sometimes I do let my libertarian colors show, especially like there's a surveillance bill coming out next week that Ron Wyden and Senator Steve Daines and Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren and Congressman Warren Davidson are sponsoring. And we're going to let our libertarian colors fly on that one. But you're right. Like Julie Borowski, Matt Kibbe, I mean, Matt's not there anymore. Austin, Julie, and Matt are no longer at FreedomWorks, but FreedomWorks still has like a very strong libertarian presence. My staff certainly has very strong libertarian tendencies. And two of them certainly identify as constitutional conservatives and have very strong libertarian tendencies. One of them is a guy by the name of Josh Withrow, and Josh actually worked at FreedomWorks under Kibbe with Julie and others. We just brought him back on, and Josh is Josh is probably even more. He's more of the traditional libertarian than I am, where he's not as pragmatic as I am, but Josh is also one of the smartest people I know. And I have another staffer, Luke, who just refers to himself as an anti-statist. He doesn't really identify as a conservative or libertarian.
You get these guys, they're so libertarian. My co-host Harry's like this, that they won't identify as libertarian. And you're just like, ugh, just pick a thing.
Just pick a thing. But yeah, he's super smart kid. He's only 22. And I've hired like three of my staffers are 24 or under. And they are the smartest kids I know, and certainly even smarter than most adults I've met. And my immediate deputy is a girl by the name of Sarah Anderson. And Sarah is 23 going on 40. She's got a good head on her shoulders, and she's going to be a rock star one day. Watch out. Watch her career. She hosts our podcast. We have a podcast at FreedomWorks that comes on Facebook every Friday.
What's it called?
I forgot the name.
Damn, son. All right. Well, I'll put it in the show notes so that people can go. Is it in iTunes? Is it an audio
podcast? Yeah, it is on iTunes. If you give me a second, I'm really bad with remembering stuff like that. So I will.
So
I will
let me set it. Up the last question here. I know you got to go, so I want to, but I think this is an important question. So hopefully you'll indulge me with your time.
Okay.
So what does your ideological diet like? What do you read? How do you research? Like, what are the things that you look at every day so you know what bills are going on? Like, if you were to give people like two or three things that really help you prepare for what you do to understand what you do, what would it be?
So I'll answer that. The podcast is called Pardon the Disruption, and I can't believe I forgot that.
That's okay.
Because we actually have a very funny intro, so people should definitely go check it out. I'm on the podcast probably twice or two or three times a month. So the nature of my job dictates that I have to study a lot of process stuff in Congress, and also learn a lot of, and go back and read the congressional record and a lot of stuff like that. Which sucks, but like it's just the nature of my job. But when I was writing the Article One paper, I found myself quoting like Elizabeth Price Foley, who's a law professor down in Florida, quoting the Founding Fathers and pulling from. I mean, actually, in the last year, I probably spent more time reading the Federalist Papers than I ever have, writing that paper and writing other things about, you know, impeachment or the Electoral College or whatever the case may be. Still read Milton Friedman Hayek when I have opportunities to, when it's directly relates. So you can't really read Hayek a lot when you're writing about criminal justice reform.
He's hard to read, period.
Yeah, that's fair. So generally what I'm reading, what I read these days, is that sort of stuff. I read the congressional, every week I have to write this newsletter. So I talk about, you know, what's happening on the Hill. So I have to go look at the House Rules Committee website, see what bills are coming in for. But the newsletter does me an opportunity to talk a little bit more about libertarian philosophy, or at least pull from libertarian writers. So I read Reason. I still read a lot of stuff at Cato. Those are probably the two most prominent libertarian organizations that produce produce content that I read regularly. So I'd say that's probably pretty much it. The main places I get my news from these days is like Politico and The Hill. I really don't read much else. And then I don't watch cable news or listen to talk radio. I haven't listened to talk radio in 10 years, and I haven't watched cable news in 5. But I do watch C-SPAN because the nature of my job, you know.
I think if you do sort of what you do, I think you'll be – it's a lot of what I do for this. I mean, I try not – I really don't watch cable news ever. I think any form of television news is insulting to your intelligence. Talk radio is a form of propaganda by and large, you know. So I seek out a lot of the exact same sources you do. So I think that's like the sugary treats is really like, what it sounds like you avoid.
No, I mean, I try to avoid stuff like that as much as I can. Every now, like during the when the Soleimani strike happened, I did have to. I tuned in the cable news because I needed to see immediately what was going on. See, I don't think C-SPAN was covering it, so I had to like turn it on CNN for a little bit and checked it out and see what was going on. I don't watch Fox. I can't watch Fox News. I can't watch MSNBC. I usually just keep it on CNN. You know, but like those are the main sources. I mean, I'm trying to think of other stuff because, like, even yesterday when I was writing this week's newsletter, I think a lot of this, like, especially when it relates to a piece of legislation on the floor that's coming to the floor. Like, there's a bill next week on the floor, and I'm not sure when you're going to run this, but there's a bill next week on the floor that basically deals with credit reporting of student loans. So if someone makes a payment for nine out of 10 months, consecutive months, a credit reporting agency cannot report as derogatory or delinquent or default any student loan. Like, if they pay for 10 months, 9 out of 10 months, and they default or go delinquent, credit reporting agency can't say anything about it. And this only relates to private loans. The repayment rate for private loans is like 98%. This is effectively not a problem. Now, granted, this doesn't talk about the cost of college. So, writing this yesterday, I haven't pulled a good Reason magazine article about it, but I'm going to go try to find one probably tonight when I get home and basically link back to it. Like, guys, you know, Robbie Sowover, whoever it is at Reason, points out, like, the real problem here is the cost of college. You know, it's federal government involvement. It's the federal subsidy that is the problem. So because government keeps subsidizing loans, the cost of education keeps going higher. You reduce the subsidy, the cost of education is going to go down. Because, you know, I mean, that's it. And that's the kind of stuff I will point to, you know, Reason, Cato, whatever the case may be. Especially like war powers, education, criminal justice, surveillance issues. Like, those places are always really good sources. And probably my favorite writer out of anybody right now is Alex Nerostra, who writes a lot about immigration. So, which we're great. We're dabbling in a little bit now, but we're not restrictionists.
Yeah,
so.
He's worked for Cato.
Long time.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is the end of the program here. If people want to follow you, it's shameless self-promotion time. What would you like our listeners to do?
Twitter.com/pye, or freedomworks.org. I think /Jason-pye is my bio. And I think my most recent blog posts are somewhere on the right column. Or you can just do freedomworks.org and read all of our stuff. You know, my stuff tends to be more about policy and process than libertarian philosophy, but I do occasionally go crazy.
That's our audience. They want the hearty meal. They don't want your libertarian philosophy. That's what they got Tom Woods for. All right. Thanks so much for joining me. I really do appreciate your time.
That's what Tom Woods is for, speaking of people who aren't libertarians.
Oh man.
Chris, I enjoyed it. It's good seeing you again. It's been too long, so let's make that, like, let's change that going forward. Let's talk more often.
Yeah, I'll be through Georgia later this year, so I'll hit you up and maybe we can grab lunch or something.
Oh, definitely. All right, dude. Thanks, man.
All right, thanks. Take care. Bye-bye. You too.